If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblogues.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we take a mountain of sources, strip away the jargon, and, well, we deliver you the essential knowledge shortcut. Today, we're dissecting the one financial concept that acts as a kind of global economic fingerprint. We're talking about the cost of money for the very best borrowers.
We are talking about the prime rate.
Exactly, the prime rate. This is a fundamental building block that, I mean, it's what moves your mortgage, your credit card rates, and frankly, the direction of entire national economies.
It really is. It's the rate that kind of hides in plain sight.
Yeah.
If you've ever looked at a loan document and seen an interest rate described as, you know, prime plus 4%, well, you've encountered it.
That's the one.
The prime rate, or the prime lending rate, to be formal, is the foundational interest rate that banks typically reserve for their most creditworthy customer.
Their A-listers.
The A-listers of the debt world, absolutely.
And our mission today is, I think, really critical. We're going far beyond just the definition. We're going to understand the actual mechanics of how this rate is set. Right.
You might assume it's some kind of global standard, but the way it's calculated in North America is wildly different from how it's regulated in, say, Southeast Asia.
It's a completely different philosophy, really. A philosophical divide baked right into the financial system.
And we have compiled a massive global resource that, well, it details the commercial bank prime lending rates across dozens of national currencies.
And seeing this data all in one place, it's an immediate education in global stability.
It really is.
When you look at the rate in, say, the U.S. at 7.50% and then see a neighbor like Canada at 4.95% or a global outlier like Argentina at 61.7%, you immediately gain this profound insight.
Yeah, into how the world prices risk.
Risk, inflation, stability, all of it. We're giving you the context to translate those numbers into, you know, economic reality.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We've established the core concept.
Yeah.
The prime rate is the benchmark rate for the most reliable borrowers. But what exactly does benchmark mean in practice? It means that when a bank is setting this rate, they are operating under the assumption of minimal, almost zero default risk.
Okay, so this is the gold standard.
This is the gold standard for lending rates.
Yeah.
Historically, particularly in the North American banking model, the prime rate was the rate.
The actual rate.
The actual interest rate charged to the best corporate and commercial borrowers. Now, banking dynamics have changed, and sometimes even the most creditworthy customer might pay a tiny, tiny increment above prime, but its core function remains unchanged.
It's the starting point.
It is the immovable starting point, the foundational index.
And for the average person listening, the connection to their daily financial life is, well, it's total. Even if you don't qualify for the prime rate itself. And let's be honest, most consumers won't.
Right. Most of us won't.
Your financial life is fundamentally structured around it. If you hold any variable interest rate product, that rate is almost certainly expressed as a percentage above or below the prime rate.
It's the sun around which all your consumer debt orbits.
That's a great way to put it.
This is the critical, so what's analysis, you know? The prime rate acts as the index for calculating rate changes across several major consumer products. It is the thermometer for your variable debt.
It shows you exactly when things are going to get more expensive.
Exactly when and by how much your costs are going to shift.
So give us the specific examples. What are the products that affect people most directly?
Okay. The big ones are any loans where the interest rate can fluctuate over time. We're talking about adjustable rate mortgages, or ARMs.
Right.
After that fixed introductory period ends, the rate on your ARM is typically determined by adding a predetermined margin to a selected index.
And the prime rate is often that index.
Very often. The same logic applies to many variable rate short-term loans. Think about many private student loans where the rate can reset periodically based on that prime index.
I'm guessing the most common examples, the ones that millions of people carry in their wallets every day, are credit cards and lines of credit.
Absolutely. This is where we need to introduce the concept of the spread or the margin. Exactly. When you look at the fine print for a credit card, or especially a home equity line of credit, a HELOC, the rate is almost always specified in a two-part structure.
Right.
Your total interest rate is the prime rate, which is the fluctuating index, plus a fixed value.
And that fixed value is the spread.
That fixed value is the spread, or the margin. It represents the bank's assessment of your individual credit risk, plus, of course, their desired profit margin.
So let's be hyper-specific here. Let's say the prime rate is currently 7.50%.
Okay.
Your credit card company looks at your credit score, your history, and says, okay, we think this customer is a 14-point risk.
So they add a 14% margin.
Right. Your rate is calculated as prime, which is 7.50%, plus those 14 percentage points. That makes your current interest rate 21.50%.
That is precisely how it works. And because that 14-point margin is fixed, the moment the central bank moves the foundational prime rate, your entire 21.50% rate moves up or down lockstep with it.
So the bank has already locked in their profit.
They've locked in their profit margin with the spread. The prime rate simply dictates the direction and the timing of the shift.
This shows why the prime rate isn't just some, you know, academic curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
It is the direct driver of millions of monthly interest payments.
It really is.
I think we should clarify one bit of jargon here, because we'll probably be using it constantly. We often hear the term basis points.
Oh, good idea. Yeah.
What exactly are those, and why do people in finance use them?
That's a great point. A basis point is simply 1/100th of a percentage point.
So 100 basis points equals 1.00%.
Exactly.
So why not just say 1%?
Because in finance, tiny movements matter a lot, especially in global markets. When you're dealing with huge sums of money, discussing a change of, say, 0.01% is just clumsy.
It's awkward.
It's awkward. It's far easier and, frankly, less prone to mathematical error to just say the rate moved up 25 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds more precise, and it simplifies discussions about these small fractional movements in rates like the prime rate.
Or the federal funds rate, which we'll get to.
Or the federal funds rate. It just prevents confusion between absolute percentages and percentage changes.
So if the prime rate is 7.50% and moves to 7.75%, that's a 25 basis point hike.
A 25 basis point hike.
Correct. Okay. It's a clearer way of expressing these small but really important shifts. That definitely frames the whole conversation going forward.
Mm.
Now that we understand the language and the foundational role, let's look at how the prime rate is actually born in North America.
Okay.
One of the first things that jumps out from our sources is the incredible stability and coordination.
Mm-hmm.
When a prime rate adjustment happens in the U.S. or Canada, it's not a chaotic bank-by-bank decision. It feels more like an almost simultaneous choreographed dance.
It is remarkably coordinated. And it has to be, right, to function as a reliable index.
Free.
If banks were charging vastly different prime rates, the whole system of defining risk based on that index would just fall apart.
The benchmark wouldn't be a benchmark anymore.
It wouldn't mean anything. As of the latest data we have, which is late 2025, the U.S. prime rate was sitting at 7.50%. And right next door, Canada's prime rate was a noticeably lower 4.95%.
Let's pause right there. That's a 255 basis point difference between two major economically integrated trading partners.
It's huge.
It is huge. What is that telling us?
Well, that difference is a really powerful sign of two different battles being fought by their respective central banks.
Okay.
While both the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada are fighting inflation, Canada's central bank is operating under a different set of domestic pressures.
Specifically the housing market.
Specifically the housing market and very high levels of household debt.
So if the Bank of Canada lets their rate rise too high, they risk triggering a much more immediate and, well, painful economic reckoning.
In a housing market that is much, much more sensitive to interest rate hikes than the U.S. market, yes.
Why is that?
Because many Canadian mortgages reset much more frequently than the typical 30-year fixed U.S. mortgage.
Oh.
So a rate hike is felt by homeowners much faster.
I see.
Maintaining a lower prime rate helps manage that immense household debt burden, even if it means inflation control takes a slightly different, maybe slower path than the U.S. approach.
So that 255 basis point gap is basically a shorthand for two different monetary philosophies addressing different domestic vulnerabilities.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Okay, let's focus now on the U.S. mechanics, because it features this crucial, almost mathematical relationship with the actions of the Federal Reserve. You mentioned the U.S. system is benchmarked in a very specific way.
It is the defining feature of the U.S. prime rate. It floats approximately 300 basis points, or 3 full percentage points, above the federal funds rate.
Okay, that 300 basis points, Brett, is the magic number. But for the listener who needs that knowledge shortcut, what is the federal funds rate?
The federal funds rate is the rate commercial banks charge each other for extremely short-term, usually overnight loans.
Just to each other.
Just to each other. They use these loans to meet their mandated reserve funding requirements. It is the absolute base cost of short-term money in the U.S. banking system. If a bank needs cash immediately to balance its books for the day, that's the rate it pays its peers.
And who sets the target for this rate?
That responsibility falls squarely on the Federal Open Market Committee, or the FOMC.
The FOMC.
You can think of the FOMC as the steering wheel of the U.S. economy. They are the policy-setting arm of the Federal Reserve. They meet 8 times a year, or, you know, sometimes more in emergencies, to set a target range for that federal funds rate.
So when we hear on the news the Fed raised rates, they're talking about raising the target for the federal funds rate.
That's what they mean.
And because the prime rate is tethered almost exactly 300 basis points above it, the FOMC's decision instantly translates into what major banks charge their most creditworthy commercial customers.
It's a direct, almost hydraulic link.
It is hydraulic. So why that 300 basis point margin? If the Fed funds rate is the cost of money between banks, why do they charge their safest customers 3% more? Is that just pure profit?
Not entirely, no. That spread incorporates several essential costs that banks have that the Fed funds rate doesn't cover.
Like what?
We're talking about liquidity costs, the costs of maintaining regulatory capital buffers, the costs associated with FDIC insurance, compliance.
All the overhead of just being a bank.
All the overhead. The 300 basis point gap is the necessary buffer that allows banks to cover their operating costs and make a baseline profit even on their safest commercial loan without, you know, undercutting the stability of the whole system.
That makes a lot of sense. It's the minimum required cost for a bank to function as a business, even before considering individual risk.
Right.
Now, you mentioned that the prime rate is a step up from the interbank rate. What rate do banks use for the absolute most creditworthy ultra-secure lending?
For those rare, absolute best-in-class borrowers, we're talking massive multinational corporations, they often secure loans based on rates tied very, very closely to the interbank market.
So like the federal funds rate plus a tiny increment.
Exactly. Or other global benchmark rates.
Let's talk about one of those global benchmarks because it's a crucial historical reference point. LIBOR.
Ah, LIBOR. Yes. LIBOR stands for the London Interbank Offered Rate.
And for decades, this was the most important number in finance, right?
It was the world's most crucial benchmark. Absolutely. It was used for trillions of dollars in commercial loans, mortgages, derivatives globally. It essentially just asked large banks what rate they would charge each other for unsecured short-term lending.
And our sources mentioned it's being phased out globally. Why?
It's a great example of trust eroding in the financial system. LIBOR was based on a survey.
A survey.
Yes. Banks essentially reported what they thought they would charge. This opened the door to manipulation, and there were massive scandals where banks were found to be colluding to fix the reported rate to benefit their own trading positions.
So the whole thing was compromised.
The trust was gone. Because of this lack of reliability and susceptibility to abuse, regulators worldwide have mandated its replacement with more robust transaction-based rates.
Like SOFR in the U.S.
Like the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, or SOFR in the U.S., exactly.
So the shift away from LIBOR proves that the integrity of the index is everything.
Paramount.
And that brings us perfectly to a fascinating story in our source material about the integrity of the U.S. prime rate index itself. Specifically, how the Wall Street Journal publishes it.
Ah, yes. The methodology shift, it's a subtle change, but it tells a powerful story about power and concentration in the financial sector.
And the Wall Street Journal is the official source, right? The accepted publisher.
It is. They are the official, widely accepted source for publishing the U.S. prime rate.
And prior to December 17, 2008, which is right in the middle of the global financial crisis, they had a very rigid, consensus-based methodology.
They did. The old way required 23 out of 30 of the largest U.S. banks to change their prime rates before the journal would officially publish the new consensus rate.
So it had to be a broad movement.
It ensured that the rate reflected a very broad cross-section of the market.
But the financial crisis triggered massive consolidation.
Yeah.
The banking landscape changed. I mean, overnight, fewer larger banks survived and now control a vastly greater share of the assets.
And the journal had to adapt its standard to reflect this new reality. They recognized that relying on a consensus of 30 institutions was no longer relevant when, you know, three or four banks held half the market's assets.
So what's the new way?
The new policy is that they publish a rate reflecting the base rate posted by at least 70% of the top 10 banks by assets.
So basically, 7 of the 10 biggest banks.
7 of the 10 biggest.
That seemingly small editorial change at the Wall Street Journal is actually a headline about bank consolidation. It means that the foundational rate for the entire country is essentially decided by 7 massive financial institutions.
It's an operational change that shifts the power structure significantly. It proves that even a rate that appears mathematically fixed, 300 basis points above the Fed funds rate, is actually a reflection of evolving market concentration and the resulting shift in decision-making power.
It's a nuanced detail that shows how deep you have to go to really understand these financial mechanics.
It really is.
That structure in North America market consensus, driven by the Big Ten banks, tethered to the Fed funds rate, it's a very capitalist, market-driven mechanism.
It is.
Now, let's pivot entirely. We're going to Southeast Asia, to Malaysia, to examine a structure that attempts to prioritize transparency and central regulation over that kind of market activity.
This is a crucial transition because it really highlights the divergence in global monetary philosophy. In Malaysia, the authorities decided that the old system, the base lending rate, or BLR, was opaque.
Opaque how?
It didn't allow consumers to easily compare loan offers. So effective January 2, 2015, they implemented a major regulatory shift, replacing the BLR with the new base rate, or BR, system.
The primary goal was transparency, right? If consumers can't easily figure out why one bank is offering a better rate than another, then the market isn't really functioning efficiently.
Exactly. The government wanted consumers to be able to look at Bank A and Bank B and understand immediately where the differences in their loan costs were coming from.
So how does this new base rate, the BR, actually work? Is it still tied to interbank lending rates, or did the central bank, Bank Negara, take control?
Bank Negara, Malaysia's central bank, took control of the methodology. The BR serves as the main reference rate for new retail floating rate loans, but, and this is the key, banks don't determine their BR by waiting for consensus or by looking solely at interbank rates.
Okay, so how do they do it?
They determine their BR based on a strict, centrally mandated formula set by Bank Negara.
A formula. So the central bank essentially dictates the inputs for the formula. What kind of inputs are mandatory?
The primary inputs are the bank's own funding costs, which are directly tied to the central bank's overnight policy rate, or OPR. They also must factor in costs related to meeting the statutory reserve requirement. That's the mandatory capital banks must hold, plus liquidity costs and administrative overhead.
So by mandating the inclusion of these specific transparent costs in the formula, the central bank ensures consistency across the whole sector.
That's the idea. Consistency and transparency.
That's a fascinating contrast to the U.S. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., the 7.50% prime rate is an aggregation of what the market is doing. In Malaysia, the base rate is a derived figure based on mandated regulatory input parameters. Can you give us an example of what that initial rate looked like?
Yes. At the time of the transition, Malayan Banking Berhad, or Maybank, which is a massive institution, set its initial group-wide base rate at 3.2%.
And that 3.2% wasn't just chosen out of thin air?
Not at all. It was the precise output of applying the Bank Negara formula to their own internal cost structure.
Now, this raises a crucial question, one the U.S. system sort of avoids. Doesn't a centrally formulaic system like the BR stifle competition?
It's a valid concern.
If the index is largely dictated, aren't banks just competing on, you know, who has the best lobby and the best coffee?
That's where the competitive dynamics shift. They aren't allowed to compete on the underlying cost of funding that's standardized by the formula. They compete vigorously on the next component. The margin.
The spread again?
The spread again. This is where the effective lending rate, or ELR, becomes the key differentiator.
So the ELR is the rate the customer actually pays, the BR plus the margin.
Exactly. And the margin is determined by the bank's assessment of the customer's credit risk and the specific product's profit target. A bank that is very efficient, or maybe one that is aggressively pursuing market share, can set a lower margin for their most creditworthy customers.
So if I walk into two different Malaysian banks, and Bank A has a BR of 3.3% and Bank B has a BR of 3.1%, Bank A can still win my business.
They absolutely can if they offer a lower margin.
How would that work?
Bank A might offer a spread of, say, BR plus 0.5%, making the ELR 3.8%. Bank B might have a lower BR, but offer a spread of BR plus 0.8%, making their ELR 3.9%.
Ah, so even though Bank A's base cost, the BR is higher, their final effective rate is lower.
Precisely. The BR system forces banks to differentiate themselves not on secretive funding costs, but on their efficiency, their risk assessment, and their willingness to sacrifice margin for volume. It increases transparency for the consumer while shifting the competitive battlefield for the banks.
And just to wrap up that transition, what happened to all the historical loans? If I took out a 30-year mortgage under the old BLR system in 2010, was I forced to renegotiate in 2015?
No, that would cause chaos.
And violate contracts.
And violate existing contracts. Loans approved and extended before January 2, 2015 were grandfathered in. They continue to follow the old base lending rate, the BLR system, until the end of their loan tenure.
It highlights the long tail of these financial transitions. You can't just flip a switch.
You can't. You end up with two parallel financial systems coexisting for decades as old contracts slowly mature and fall off the books.
We've built up a strong understanding of the mechanics. Now we shift our focus to the global perspective, and this is where the picture gets truly dramatic.
It really does.
We're relying on this incredible, extensive list of commercial bank prime lending rates, compiled from sources like Trading Economics and the World Bank.
This list is stunning. It's a snapshot of global financial health captured in a single percentage point. We are moving from the, you know, tightly controlled mechanics of the U.S. and Malaysia to the harsh, unpredictable reality of global markets.
You see rates ranging from a fraction of a percent to well over 60%.
It's incredible.
And this data leads us to the central question we posed earlier. What do these numbers reveal about global economic stability, inflation, and underlying risk?
When you see this single cost, the price of credit for a bank's safest customer, you are seeing the financial fingerprint of a nation.
So let's start where the distress is highest, the absolute extremes.
Okay. These are the countries where even the most reliable borrower is paying rates that would be considered, well, predatory in the West.
Take us through that shocking top tier.
We have to begin with Argentina, clocking in at a staggering 61.70%. That's 2024 data.
61%.
Brazil follows closely at 58.3% for June 2025. We see Madagascar at 53.60% in 2023 and Zimbabwe at 42.50% for July 2025.
Over 60% for a prime borrower. I mean, that rate is almost impossible to comprehend from a stable economy's perspective.
Sure.
What is the practical implication of money costing that much?
The implication is profound. First, high rates just scream high inflation, often hyperinflationary pressures. The bank has to charge that rate just to maintain the real value of its principal against rapid currency decay.
Right. But practically?
But more practically, lending effectively collapses.
How so?
In an economy where the safest money costs 61%, long-term business planning effectively stops. It can't happen. Borrowing at those rates means you're effectively consuming your principal just to pay the interest.
Can you break that down?
Sure. If you borrow $100,000 at 61.70%, you owe nearly $62,000 in interest in the first year alone. Unless you have a business that yields returns vastly higher than 61%, which is extremely rare and usually confined to high-risk speculation, you cannot sustain that debt.
So consumer mortgages are just off the table.
Virtually non-existent.
Yeah.
Or they must be extremely short-term. It's the antithesis of the stable, predictable environment needed for long-term capital formation.
It's an environment where capital flight is probably rampant because there's no incentive to hold or invest currency domestically.
Precisely. And the bank has to price in massive currency instability and high political risk. They need a huge premium to account for the possibility that the value of the currency collapses or the government imposes some drastic wealth-eroding measure.
So the high prime rate is a measure of the deep mistrust banks have.
Deep mistrust in the stability of the local economy and government. Yes.
Moving slightly down the spectrum, we still see many countries in that mid to high range, often those dealing with geopolitical stress or intense currency defense efforts.
Absolutely. Look at the geopolitical cluster. Russia at 21.75%, Ukraine at 19.96%, and Egypt at 24.2%.
All those rates are from June 2025. The proximity is striking.
It tells a clear story. In the case of Russia and Ukraine, borrowing costs are high not just because of local inflation, but due to baked-in war risk, sanctions, and the desperate need of the central banks to defend their currencies.
When the war risk is high, the cost of capital is high.
It has to be. And for Egypt, a rate of 24.20% indicates persistent structural issues with inflation control and often the management of their sovereign debt.
And when your best borrowers are paying nearly a quarter of the principal in annual interest.
The average citizen is paying far more, which severely restricts economic activity and dramatically limits who can participate in the formal economy. We also see countries like Malawi at 37.0%. These are just incredibly challenging economic environments.
Let's bring it back to our familiar neighborhood in the developed world. The U.S. at 7.50% and Canada at 4.95%.
When you place them next to the 60% outliers, these rates look incredibly low and stable.
But compared to their peers, they're distinct. The U.S. prime rate of 7.50% is slightly below the U.K.'s 8.61%, but significantly higher than Germany's 4.00%.
Right.
Why the difference between the U.S. and the U.K.? They're facing similar inflationary pressures post-pandemic.
The U.K. has struggled with very persistent inflationary spikes, partially driven by energy costs and supply chain disruptions that were, you know, exacerbated by geopolitical events and internal political turbulence.
So their central bank has been more aggressive.
The Bank of England has had to maintain higher base rates for longer to try and anchor those inflation expectations, and that feeds directly into that higher commercial prime rate.
And what about Australia, sitting higher than all of them at 10.26%, a highly developed, stable economy?
Australia is a perfect example of a country whose central bank, the Reserve Bank of Australia, has been incredibly aggressive in tackling inflation.
Why so aggressive?
In part because they have a high exposure to resource exports and a structurally sensitive housing market. They have chosen to prioritize controlling price increases, which means high rates over easing household debt burdens.
So that's a different policy trade-off than the one we saw in Canada.
A very different policy trade-off, yes.
Okay, now let's go to the other side of the spectrum, the lowest rates globally. If high rates imply high risk, what does extremely cheap money signify?
It usually signals one of two things. Either sustained low inflation, often bordering on deflationary pressures, or a deliberate long-term policy of aggressive economic stimulus. The central bank is essentially forcing capital out of savings and into investment.
The low numbers here are just as extreme as the high numbers. Japan, famous for its deflationary struggles, sits at a prime rate of 2.2%.
Right. Spain is 2.18% and Denmark is at 1.75%.
But the absolute outlier, the global winner for the cheapest credit for its safest customers, is Peru.
Peru, with a commercial bank prime lending rate of only 1.81% as of July 2025.
Less than 1%.
Sure.
I mean, that means the theoretical margin on the safest loans for a Peruvian bank is almost non-existent. Does that indicate that the Peruvian economy is booming or the opposite?
It generally indicates the opposite. The central bank is deeply worried about stimulating aggregate demand. A rate this low is a massive, aggressive incentive for investment and consumption.
So capital is effectively abundant.
Capital is abundant, and risk is perceived as extremely low by the banking system. Or, more accurately, the central bank is determined to keep it low to spur activity. They are using their primary tool to avoid stagnation or deflation.
Let's look for geographical clustering.
Right.
That often reveals coordinated policy efforts.
The Eurozone is the clearest example of this stability and coordination.
Right.
When you look at Italy at 4.11%, France at 3.65%, Germany at 4.00%, and the Netherlands at 2.47%, they all cluster together pretty tightly.
And they all operate under the European Central Bank.
Exactly.
Yeah.
While they aren't identical, the Netherlands' lower rate might reflect better internal banking stability. The fact that they all operate under the ECB's mandate means their base cost of money has to be similar. Their cluster reflects shared stability and synchronized monetary policy.
But then we see these surprising contrasts, even among countries that are geographically or culturally close.
The Nordic region provides a stark example. You have Iceland, with a prime rate of 12.5%.
12.5%.
Contrasted sharply with its Nordic neighbor, Norway, which is at 6.10%.
Big difference.
It is. Iceland has historically dealt with higher volatility, higher inflation, and a different reliance on its export markets, and that's reflected in their significantly higher cost of credit.
And the contrast right here in North America, Mexico sitting at 11.20%, right next to the U.S. at 7.5%, and Canada at 4.95%.
Mexico's higher rate reflects the necessary premium to manage currency risk and internal inflation that its northern neighbors simply don't share to the same degree. It's a reflection of the challenges of maintaining financial stability while dealing with global capital flows and commodity price volatility.
Pressures that Canada and the U.S. can absorb more easily.
Because of their reserve currencies and just sheer economic size, yes. The prime rate in all these cases is truly the financial reality check of a country's economic management.
And this list, spanning from 0.81% in Peru to 61.70% in Argentina, it underscores a core truth. The interest rate world is not flat.
Not at all.
What is considered prime and low risk in one market would be considered a catastrophic rate in another. So we've broken down the definition, the mechanics, and the global implications of the prime rate. Let's synthesize the core knowledge shortcut we've delivered today.
Okay.
The prime rate is a fluctuating index, defined as the benchmark rate for a bank's most creditworthy customers.
And its determination varies based on regulatory philosophy. In the United States, it operates on a mechanical, predictable spread 300 basis points above the federal funds rate.
Which is governed by the FOMC.
Governed by the FOMC and published based on the consolidated power of the top 10 banks.
While systems like Malaysia's base rate, the BR, operate based on a formula set by the central bank, Bank Negara.
Right, forcing competition onto the margin or the spread rather than the core cost of capital.
Both systems aim for stability, but they approach the definition of index integrity from completely different starting points.
And when you view these different systems through the lens of that global spectrum, you realize that the commercial bank prime lending rate is the single most efficient indicator of a country's financial health.
A rate near 60% shows a country struggling for economic survival.
And a rate below 2% shows a country struggling against stagnation and deflationary pressures.
So what should you, the listener, take away from all this data?
This raises, I think, a really important and provocative question for you to mull over. We've established that the prime rate reflects the cost of money for the safest borrowers. But the vast majority of consumers and small businesses are not prime.
Right. They're charged a risk premium, a spread above that baseline.
Exactly. If you're an average borrower, you're paying prime plus some percentage, sometimes a very large percentage, depending on your risk profile.
Okay.
But consider the multiplier effect. If the prime rate in Peru is 0.81%, the spread charged to the average small business owner in Peru starts at an incredibly low floor.
Right.
If the prime rate in Argentina is 61.70%, that same small business owner's starting floor is already ruinously high.
So the cost of simply being an average borrower rather than a prime borrower
is exponentially more expensive in unstable economies.
Yeah.
The geopolitical reality of credit risk means that your local economy not only dictates the cost of your money, but fundamentally defines your ability to accumulate wealth. That difference is where the real cost of debt begins.